Welcome to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
My name is Jill.
And my name is Michael.
Catch us every other Wednesday talking about books, publishing, indie bookstores, chatting with authors, and so much more.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Book It Pod for more Book It content.
Want to read something you heard about on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/BookItPod.
We want to give a huge shout out to today's sponsor, Two Rivers Bookstore, which is an independent bookstore in St. John, Oregon, but more on them later.
How are you?
You know, I'm pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've had a wild but exciting week. How about you?
I have something that I think you haven't seen because you haven't mentioned it to me yet. Shout out to our friend Andrea.
Oh, yeah.
She had her baby today.
Yes.
Samuel.
Yeah, I love that name.
I feel like, so Andrea is an author.
Yes.
She's been a guest on our podcast. Mm-hmm. We've worked with her.
Yes.
She's one of our favorite people.
In the world.
Her and her husband Drew and their daughter Louise have a new family member today.
Yeah.
I have pictures.
Oh!
I knew you hadn't seen them.
Yay!
I have kept this secret all day. Are you impressed?
I'm so impressed. Maybe she texted me. I haven't seen it yet. Sorry, Andrea, if you did.
I'm passing it to you.
Oh, my gosh. Andrea, I know you're listening, so. Oh, my gosh. Wow.
The baby's adorable.
Honestly.
She sent me two cute photos.
I really see a lot of, I never say this, but I really see a lot of both of them already in Samuel.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, and I see Louise.
I'm so bad at the who does the baby look like game.
Oh, a brand new baby monster. Speaking of which, Andrew Fiverr has a book out called Baby Monster. Go buy it.
There's going to be a new baby in your family too, right?
Yes. Sorry. Sorry, family who listens. Not my baby.
Michael looked like he was going to die right on the spot. Like, leaving today with a baby. Surprise.
I was just like, what does she know that I don't know?
Which is better than the first iteration of this conversation where I said, I have a surprise for you.
And all the color drained from my face.
And I was like, hello, I am in my 40s and I already have four children.
Well, Janet Jackson was in her 50s when she had her kid.
I don't have Janet Jackson's money.
I didn't know what to expect. Yeah. Yes. My sister is having her second and I am so excited. Mm-hmm. Eloise is like my favorite person on the planet. She's my niece. I just can't wait for her to be a big sister.
Aww. Yeah.
Babies all around.
I know. Our friends and family have been very busy.
No.
No.
No. No, they weren't. The stork definitely brought Eloise in.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
No, I'm not a prude. I don't give a shit. Yes, they had sex and are having children.
I don't know what to say.
There's nothing to say other than welcome to Book
It. Welcome
to
Book It.
You know that we are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk about books, frankly. And today is a tradition that we do throughout season two, where last episode was our book club chat about Revival Season by Monica West. And today we are bringing you our interview with Monica West about Revival Season.
I am so excited for everybody to hear this. I know we talked about it a little bit at the end of the last episode, but she was so interesting to talk to. And I'm excited for everybody to hear about this because at several points, Michael and I were like, you have to write a book about that.
Yes. Write a book about that. Like, that's going to be your sequel.
And also, is it in the recording or not when she tells us what she's working on?
It's in the recording. I kind of forced her to do that.
And it sounds so good.
Amazing.
All right. No more spoilers.
Yeah. And no more like forcing our authors to like reveal information they don't want to reveal.
Unless it's a baby picture and then you have
Yes, exactly. I think we've gotten really lucky on Book It with our author interviews. Every single person has been not just a delight, but so thoughtful and interesting and has not completely changed, but has offered me more insight into this thing I just read.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter though. Every single time before we have an author interview, I get really nervous. I'm just like, I hope this one's good. I hope they offer us some information. And Monica West did not disappoint. She was just so thoughtful and such a listener. Like, she really listened to our questions and gave us really, really thoughtful answers.
All right, let's hear what Monica has to say.
Okay, as our listeners know, Jill, you're a tiny bit obsessed with Christmas.
Guilty as charged. Have I mentioned it a few times?
Well, yes. And did you know that this month's featured indie bookstore, Two Rivers Books, has a holiday night market each year?
What? I need more information immediately.
Okay, here we go. The holiday night market features all of the really cool local items that Two Rivers carries, plus even more local artisans that they can't normally fit into their retail space.
It's official. I'm going. You're going. Let's go together. Holiday markets are second only to Hallmark movies on Jill's official guide to holiday merriment, patent pending. That's it. You'll be able to find me in St. John's, Oregon. I'm leaving.
Oh, okay, well, maybe let's finish this episode first.
Why do you not want me to be filled with the spirit of the season?
Wow. Oh, wow. Okay, I'm going to ignore that. You can find Two Rivers Books at tworiversbooks.com and also on Jill's Guide to Holiday Merriment. So we are so excited to be here today with Monica West. Monica was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and received her BA from Duke University, her MA from New York University, and her MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop, where she was a Rona Jeffe Graduate Fellow. She was a Southern Methodist University Cambilio Fellow in 2014, and she will be a Hedgebrook Writer in Residence in 2021. Revival Season is her first novel, and we are so excited that it was a book club pick here on Book It. And we're even more excited that Monica's here with us today. Thank you so much for sitting down with us, Monica.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
We fell in love with Revival Season before we even read it. Michael and I are always joking that we are terrible people because we are obsessed with book covers.
Yours is like top of the top.
Yes. The cover grabbed us, and then we read the synopsis and fell in love. And just for any of our listeners who haven't read Revival Season yet, can you give us a brief synopsis?
Sure. Revival Season is the story of 15-year-old Miriam Horton, who is the oldest daughter in a conservative evangelical community of Baptists. Her father is a revival preacher and a faith healer. And so every summer, Miriam and her family pack up in their old van and they travel across the South for healing services and these kind of spiritual events. And over the course of one summer, Miriam witnesses a pretty startling act of violence from her father on the revival circuit. And then it kind of throws all the things that she's thought about her father and her faith into turmoil. And then soon after returning from that summer's revival circuit, Miriam has a moment, something accidental that opens her eyes up to something potentially that she has, that she's been told that women and girls in the church aren't supposed to have. So the rest of the book is just about Miriam kind of thinking about her own power, stepping into her own power and coming to terms with the kind of question she's had for her whole about her family. And so that's what Revival Season's about.
I am so excited to talk about this today. For those of us who grew up around Southern evangelicals, the atmosphere of revival just felt like a trip home. Mm-hmm. And there were so many details that grabbed me, like the teens arriving, you know, and there's kind of low-key flirting and you like this other boy who's there and is he going to be there? And, you know, the tiny cups of grape juice and the tent lights and the crickets and the field. It just all really spoke to me. And I was curious, when you began writing, did you start with the revival and go from there? Or did it start more with the characters and the narrative elements and evolve? And I'm super curious, did you hit the revival circuit?
Okay, great questions. The book actually started with a little bit before the first revival. So the book, the opening of the book is actually the beginning that I originally wrote. So much of the book has changed in revision, but the opening first pages are pretty close to what I wrote when I started the book 9 years ago. And it began with the journey to the first revival. So I started the book with the van on the road and I was trying to figure out what was happening with the van and who was in it and what they're doing. and why this matters. And then I kind of backfilled the idea of religion onto this van moving. And so them going to Americus, that first revival stop in the new revival season, is the way the book began. So it began with the idea of a journey. And then I went through the idea of character first. And then I got into the revivals. So I thought about who's in this van and why are they here? And what's the tension in the van? And then getting into some of the revivals that I spent some time developing. And so the answer to the other part of your question is, I did spend some time researching revivals and also attending some that were not the same that were the ones in the book. So I've been to some of the more city, like bigger revivals, like those experiences, like they, you know, happen at stadiums. And then I've also been to smaller ones and I've been to churches in the South. And so I spent some time weaving those experiences together with research, with my own experience to try to make that revival circuit just right. So I have never actually been kind of going from place to place and tent to tent. The way the Hortons do, but I tried to kind of bring together my experiences along with research to make that feel as true to what I feel like the experience would be.
Yeah, it's touching on sort of like that going from place to place. In our first two book clubs, The Kindest Lie and The Prophets, we talked a lot about perspective and place, and both of those books were told from various perspectives and had an emphasis on place. Mm-hmm. And Revival Season is our first book club pick that's first person, it's one narrator, and the place is like ever changing. And it was just an interesting contrast to the books we've read previously, and I'm just curious about your process with this. Was it always Miriam's story? Was it always from like 15 years old? Because 15 years old is already like an impossibly difficult time in our lives, and sort of the map of the story, like how did that come about?
Right, so it was always going to be Miriam's story. And I knew that from the beginning. And the reason it was always Miriam's story is because she's the character who's capable of the most change in the book. So this idea of, I wanted it to be this person whose beliefs are broken all the way apart. And that wasn't going to happen with Caleb in some way. And I was less concerned, to be honest, with the male narrators in the story. Right. I was way more concerned with the voices of women in the book. And so I thought about it. So if it would have to have been Miriam, her mother, her sister, Hannah. And so Miriam was then the one the most capable of seeing the family and the faith and the fragility of all of it for what it really is. She's less inundated, you know, she's not as inundated as her mother is. And so then that brings up the idea of her being 15. She started when I first started this book, she was 13. And she was younger than Caleb. Caleb was 15, Miriam was 13. And in a pretty late edit, my editor told me that, I think for reasons of audience, that it's easier when for an adult audience to kind of think about a narrator being 15 rather than 13. And so I raised Miriam's age, and in doing so, made her the oldest. So she went from being the middle to the oldest. And that then shifted the power dynamic of going from being the overlooked one, as she would be when she's the middle child, to being the heir apparent necessarily, but then being the girl and then kind of being looked over that way. So it also helped shift that. I've been a high school teacher for about 13 years, and I spent a more time, I think, with teenagers than I do with adults. And so that idea of being 15 is pretty much when adolescents and young people start really differentiating themselves from their parents and having this idea of, I have an idea, I have an identity, I have a voice, I have thoughts that are separate from you. And not only that, there's this profound moment of seeing your parents as people. And that also means seeing your parents as flawed and seeing your parents as maybe problematic in ways that you would have never allowed yourself to see when you still worship them. So when she became 15, a whole bunch of new possibilities opened themselves up to me. But it was always Miriam's story, in my opinion. A while ago, I was approaching this agent some years ago when I was at Iowa, and she said, I think the book is missing Caleb's point of view. And I said, well, that's the point for me. It matters what Miriam thinks. Right. So it was always Miriam. That's always been my narrative for this book. So
when you said that edit came kind of late to make her 15, mm-hmm. What were there any like drastic changes you had to make because of that?
Not really. I think my editor told me that Miriam's voice was already felt. One of her things was Miriam's voice felt kind of old for 13. So the 15-year-old switch didn't really make a dramatic shift in voice.
Sure.
What it did was made a shift in her relationship with her brother. So there was really deferential in some of the earlier drafts, and it's way less deferential now because she's the oldest. And so she gets to be the kind of the leader in some ways of the family, even though she doesn't get recognized for that leadership and for the role that she has. But then she's also, because she's older, she always was, regardless of age, Hannah's caretaker. And that was something that was really important to me from the beginning. And so something shifted, not voice, not plot, but definitely ideas of relationships within the family. Wow. And then also the ways I allowed her then to be more intimately connected to her mother and her mother's secrets when she's 15 that I didn't do when she was 13.
The exploration of the almost the duality of being an adult woman. One of the things that I think is really interesting is like we're in this place now where we are beginning to be aware that we teach really early. We teach our girls what, you know, that you have to change yourself to be accepted, or you have to hide parts of yourself in order to make things work. And so often it's this kind of unspoken message, and girls see it in their mother and internalize it for themselves. And I was really struck with the section of the book where Miriam and her mom's talking about listening to music and the boy she dated before. And, you know, Miriam really realizes that her mother, not only are there other aspects to her, but that she can't show them. And I was just struck by, you know, the sadness of it, but also just kind of the profound nature of this is really so much a reflection of real life.
Yeah, I think for Joanne's character too, I tried to show in the book how trapped she is in this house, in this marriage, in motherhood, and though, you know, she has accepted this role and she's taken on this mantle, I try to show us some reluctance to that for her. And Miriam gets a window to that, that allows her to be kind of the receptacle for her mom's secrets and this person that her mom can confide in. And you're right, there are these things, especially in this family, that her mother, they're parts of her mother, because the mother of all the characters in the book, Samuel was a person who, you know, came onto the revival circuit and was a boxer and then turned preacher, and then kind of everyone kind of flocked to him. But Joanne led a fully secular life until she met Samuel. And so for her to then become not only wife right away, she'd met Samuel when she was 17 and then married him when she turned 18, 6 weeks later, she then assumes this role that she's still a kid when she becomes his wife. And I don't know. And I tried to show in the book that she's really unaware of what this life looks like for her. She just knows that she loves this man. She knows that this man loves God. She then must also love God. And so it's also this then way that she comes of age. And Miriam has these moments where she sees her mom as an adult woman, and also as the teenage self that she must have had before Miriam knew her. And Miriam even sees herself. There's a moment in the beginning of the book when Miriam's looking back through a box of mementos and she sees their wedding photo, and she recognizes that her mom looks just like her and is just a teenager. And Miriam just kind of sees this vulnerability in her mom that lets her be both mother and woman, and also kind of child in some ways. And that is something that I really played with, this relationship between the two of them that allows Miriam to see her mother for who she is, but also to really have questions about her mom and really have some doubts about her mom, but all that stuff kind of rolled into that relationship.
I loved that. And I also thought, I just really appreciated the exploration of the significance of the Black church or churches in the South in general, and how they serve as like, they're a hub for socializing and friendships. It's the source of business partnerships and deals, community organizing, and of course, all the mutual aid that flows out. Mm-hmm. But it's also a position of power to cause mm-hmm. harm. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious what inspired you to explore that aspect of such a complex relationship.
Yeah, I think that anytime, as I'm thinking about the idea of power in the book, anytime one person is granted the level of power that Samuel is, it's a pretty rare and extraordinary person who doesn't let that get the best of them. Mm-hmm. And for Samuel, and I'm not giving Samuel a pass, he is not my favorite person, but he just kind of becomes who he's allowed to become. And I think a late revision to was him being a boxer as his previous life, there's this violence in his past, and there's this way that he has resorted to using his hands for harm. And I wanted to kind of play with that idea of what does it mean to heal with your hands? What does it mean to harm with your hands? And how Samuel does both. And then the healing being a question mark, you know, one of the questions is, does he ever really heal in this book? And yeah, I just thought a lot about wanting to explore for Black church and for church in general, the beauties that come from there, from community, from friendship, from this mm-hmm. whole life that Miriam feels with Micah and her mom and her sister in the basement, and that whole joy that comes from that, and the complete isolation and claustrophobia, and the ways that they're at the whim of their father's anger, and the ways when he rages in the house, when things aren't working in the church. And so I wanted to just explore what happens when power, given and granted, gets pushed to its in extreme. And for Samuel, then it becomes his second nature reaction. It's his reflex to kind of lash out in anger and violence. And so that's what I wanted to really play with. And that dynamic was interesting for me then to watch how the family responds to his violence, to his anger, and what that does to Miriam's belief as she's watching it happen with her dad.
It's all of that. And then kind of layered on top of it, I was struck by Mrs. Cade. Yeah. And in so many ways, I feel like maybe if you are a person who hasn't spent a lot of time in the South, it is very hard to understand how encompassing the church community is. And, you know, it is everything in your life. And Mrs. Cade is so complex and interesting to me. You know, in some ways, her hands are tied. If she goes against Samuel, it's the same as going against her entire community. Mm-hmm. But she clearly feels for Miriam and wants to help, and has seen, you know, a lot of this in her day. And I'm just curious, like, was that aspect of the conflict hard to write? It seems like we all want to believe like we do the right thing. It's so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, Mrs. Cade was really fascinating for me to write, because she was the one character besides Micah, but the one character kind of throughout the entire book who lives kind of outside of this frame of this family. And so we kind of have her coming in. She's part of the church, but she also has a role where she has delivered the babies in the family. And so she sees them in a really different light than he allows everyone else to. He has a very curated, you know, idea for his family from the photos in the church and from what he wants the members to see. Then Mrs. Cade kind of can shatter that, but she's this interesting insider outsider. And when Isaac is born, she notices for the first time Samuel's abuse, and she's allowed to then come. There's ways that Miriam talks about what they can't speak aloud and what they can't let anyone else know, and what their father doesn't let anyone else see. and Mrs. Cade sees it. And so she's in this insular community, but you also get the sense, I really wanted to show her as someone who, maybe for the one character in the book that we get a chance to see, maybe outside of Deacon Johnson, who then disappears, who vanishes for reasons of, you know, Samuel sends him away. But Mrs. Cade has power in that moment. She delivers the babies. She knows what's happening in this family. Her hands are tied. She can't do anything. She can't speak out against him. She can't make anything public in the church about what's going on in that household. But she can't be kind of a person who stands in and kind of supports Miriam. And she's then the first person who Miriam lets know about her secret. And that allows Miriam to kind of step into her power in new ways because Mrs. Cade believes in her. And so there's this way in which Mrs. Cade takes Miriam outside of her home and is this conduit to a life in an existence that Miriam has been sheltered from. But it also allows her to step fully into her gift. And so she was interesting and fascinating because she also stands up to Samuel in this house and he doesn't back. I mean, she doesn't back down against him.
Yeah.
Her hands are tied. She's still a woman in this church. And so she has power in this moment, but only so much.
Yeah. Mrs. Cade, I could have read a whole book about Mrs. Cade. And it just made me think, you know, it's so from Miriam's perspective, but I wonder for you, like, were there any characters that sort of threatened to take over the book for you? Like what other characters just overwhelmed you in the best way? Like when you went to write them, what were you like, okay, this is Miriam's story. I need to pull back a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that you could read a whole book about Mrs. Cade is there's a moment where people, because of the ending, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. Is there a sequel? Is there something else? And I said, you know what I could do? I could write a whole book about Mrs. Cade is what I could do. You know,
I could write that something. Book. Yes.
We'd have you on for book club part two.
Book club part two, Mrs. Cade. I could write. And so she definitely, for me, was so fascinating. I kind of really had moments when I was doing a lot of character journaling where I got way into her life as a midwife and her decision to follow Samuel and move and uproot her life and who she is and what her home life is like. And that definitely happened with her. The other character that happened with was Joanne, where because she's so complicated, when I was journaling again from her perspective, I thought so much about what her childhood was like with her father. I give glimpses of that in flashback and in Joanne talking to Miriam about things, but I'm fascinated by Joanne as a character too. And she at moments, I even had a revision where, I mean, it never made it into here, but Miriam and Joanne have this moment where a way older version of this book, Miriam and Joanne go away to see her sisters and it's their time together away from the household. And I literally spent about 60 or 80 pages just from Joanne. And that was pretty amazing for me. It all got cut because, you know, it's Miriam's story. But Mrs. Cade and Joanne were the two characters for me who threatened to kind of, I had to keep reminding myself, this is not the mom's story. This is not Mrs. Cade's story. And so I kept rooting it in Miriam. But those characters for me were really fun and fascinating to write.
I love that.
Me too. And I think that's good, though. Like, even if it gets cut, it probably helps inform better for you Miriam's thought process.
Absolutely. I thought that I was really annoyed when it got cut because you know, when you're a writer, you think it's so good. There's stuff that you think is really good. Everything is good. Everything is good. Every word matters. And I was like, I don't want this to go. But what was great about that is that even though those are in the graveyard of scenes and chapters and pages that never made this book, they really helped me inform and shape Miriam's relationship with her mother.
Absolutely.
And they helped me really think about Joanne and what matters to her. And so, no, they didn't make it in, but they helped me deepen her character.
Yeah, they're kind of in there then, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It makes me feel better about the fact that, you know, they're all in some file of things I will never ever touch again.
Now we need two follow-ups. We need a Mrs. Cade book and a Joanne book.
The revival trilogy.
Exactly.
As complicated as Miriam and Joanna's situation or relationship with one another is, I was also struck by how thoughtfully you handled the complicated feelings Miriam has for her father as they evolve through the book. She simultaneously puts her father on a plane above the rest of her family while also beginning to see his faults. And your heart breaks for her as you see her struggling. Yeah. You know, especially initially, like she wants to help her father and lift up his ministry. And she describes the idea later in the book, if she were to pull away from her family, she describes the idea of losing her father as like a black hole that seemed bigger than the presence that had inhabited it.
That's one of my favorite paragraphs.
I'm so curious how you balanced the dichotomy, the whole spectrum of Miriam's feelings.
Yeah, that was really, really, really hard. Miriam, I mean, okay, in early versions of this book where characters are, you know, like Samuel, I had to really work to make him more sympathetic. And Miriam, I had to work to make her more nuanced because this idea, there is no book if from the beginning, Miriam doubts her dad and doubts her dad all the way through. But there is a book if in the beginning, Miriam believes in her father wholeheartedly and then spends the rest of the book wrestling with 15 years of knowledge with one summer, maybe two summers of information that counteracts that knowledge and what I do with that. And so I really thought a lot about how she was raised in the ways that, you know, she was groomed to be dutiful and loyal and devoted and devout. That is to the church, and that's also to her family. And so so she kind of didn't question things before. That's the way that her family's fed her faith. And because earlier in the book, there's a part where Miriam talks about doubt being the root of all evil and doubt being sinful. And so she knows that she can't doubt because doubt then is a problem. So then what does it mean to doubt your dad? And what does it mean to doubt this person who is the kind of inextricable from the preachings and the teachings that he has? And so she couldn't just all of a sudden decide my dad's terrible and, you know, we need to go, because her dad is her dad. And he's also the pastor. And he's also the head of this church. And he's also this healer. And so there's so much history and tradition and ritual that's rooted in this family that Miriam can't just discount her father offhand. For her, this idea of it's a journey of development and it's a journey of real wrestling with these things that she doesn't want to be true. She does not want them to be true about her family. And then the more and more she faces it, she realizes that it is true. And that's just painful for her to kind of grapple with. But every time she tries to believe that something is different, her father shows her a side of himself that really upsets her. And so that's kind of how Miriam finds her way to what she feels like is the truth, is through a lot of wrestling and a lot of doubt and a lot of soul searching. But then she also has to stay loyal to her family. And so that's, it all kind of comes, you know, she has this loyalty to her mom and to Hannah especially. And so what does that look like to doubt and to really have real emotional distance when your family too is completely in support of this person that you feel like is a fraud? So there's also that element.
My heart just broke open when she kind of got to this kind of the climax of changing how she viewed her father. Especially because, you know, I know from experience how doubt is weaponized in in this kind of situation. And, you know, you are labeled as the problem and, you know, you have to separate yourself. And so just knowing for her that should she choose, if she chooses to view her father in another way and act on those feelings, what she was giving up. And I just, it was so authentic to me and I just broke open for her.
Yeah, it's so, the choice at the end, the choice of the climax, it's all this idea of kind of, even in the midst of all this stuff that is really painful for her and that kind of won't allow her to be who she's becoming,
Right.
It's still her family. And, mm-hmm. and unlike, you know, families all have different types of relationships and different degrees of closeness. But Miriam, I mean, her mom teaches her and her brother right. in the base, you know what I mean? Like they are they are with no one else. That is her, they are her blessing and her curse. And so for her then to even think about what it would be like, she has no life without them. She doesn't go to school away from home. Everything is surrounded by them. And so what would it look like for her to then have to break away from that place that has harmed her and made her who she is? And she just kind of really struggles with what that would look like and takes small steps away and comes back. And then, but when she comes back, it's not back to where she had been. It's a little bit, she's kind of distancing herself a little bit from that family unit, but it's still a huge part of who she is. And so much of the book is about that grappling and about that tug of war between her and her family and her father and her and faith and all those things.
Yeah, especially, I mean, like just what we were saying with what you were saying, Monica, about kids that age already are seeing mm-hmm. their parents differently. And in Miriam's circumstances, she's also pretty sure she's experiencing this thing that her whole life she was told specifically because she's a woman, she can't do.
Right.
It's just something I loved about Miriam in general was her perseverance and not just this thing that she knows she can do, which is heal, but in the face of her father's abuse and his lies. And I think she's so strong and she's so smart. And I want to like just tell her that over and over again, because mm-hmm. I'm not sure she mm-hmm. knows how much I know that she is so mm-hmm. smart and so strong. And I just want to know, like, I'm just curious about her trajectory, both on the page and off the page. Mm-hmm. How did she come to you and how often did she change over time? Because like I said, like so much of this book is so subtle that I have to imagine there was a lot of pulling back that you were doing as the writer.
Yep. And I think subtlety is not my strong suit at all. If it were up to me and no editing, it would just be super, I'm going to tell you what I want you to think. And these characters are all evil or all good. And
sure.
I spent a lot of time kind of really, really reining back my impulses to try to make the reader is smart and the reader can make up their own mind about how they feel about people. And for Miriam from the beginning, she just came to me feeling really trapped and came to me as this person who's done everything she's supposed to do. Miriam is is the good daughter. And then what does it mean for all these systems that you have revered and you've known for your whole life? What does it mean when those break apart slowly and systematically in front of you? And how do you, she wants to be good. She wants to be loved by her family. She wants to be loyal to them. Yeah. And I knew that from the beginning that was going to be her, but I also knew that the entirety of her character also had to have a lot of doubt in it. And in the early versions of the book, her doubt came in really early. Then it just stayed kind of one note. I doubt him. Is he real? Is he not real? Mm. And so the idea of being dutiful and being doubtful. And in revision, I had to work to initially make her a true believer. I mean, she is fully in line with her dad, fully in line with the church, fully in line with her family, all those things. And then pretty early, I had to then show how important this revival circuit was for this family. And then I had to bring in what happened the previous year and Miriam's needing. She almost, if she could speak up in these services, she would just say, Dad, we need this. And she needs it. The church and the people gathered in the revival tent need it to kind of be healed. But Miriam needs it because she's like, I need to believe that you are who I think you are. Mm. And she sees it when he heals, you know, when he is with the boy who, you know, walks in that one tent in Americus. Then in Bethel, everything falls apart in a really dramatic mm-hmm. fashion. And so I had to always toggle with Miriam between duty and doubt, between kind of loyalty and long suffering, the ways that she's also been raised to be like this. This is the family that she's been created in. Needs her to be like this, because if Miriam is too strong and too strong-willed girls don't make out well in families like this. And so she had to be, all of that had to be simmering under a surface of I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. I'm with my best friend and we're collecting the communion cups after service on Sundays. We're going to these baptism services. So all of the things that she was feeling had to be simmering beneath the surface of submissiveness, because mm-hmm. had she not done that, that would have just been, there was no way that she just had to kind of always kind of toe the line. So in revision, I made her way more, I made that nuance clearer. I also had to really step into some parts of Miriam. I mean, in my ideal version of, you know, things existing in a binary, Miriam is all good and she's not. And so by the end of the book, I also had to show Miriam in the climax scene, I had to show Miriam also becoming the thing that she was so
right
damning of her father of. And that for her to see what she was capable of was terrifying. I didn't want her to go there because I love Miriam, but I mean, she had to. And so that's something I had to work through in revision. I also spent a lot of time when she came to me thinking a lot about her role as a daughter and really cultivating that relationship with her and her mom and how that deepened over the course of the book. So those are all things that she came to me one way, who she is on the page now is still has some of the essence of who I wanted Miriam to be, with a lot more nuance that in places where I think I had a professor at Iowa tell me, you have to make your characters be mean to one another. Cause I'm conflict avoidant by nature. And so having Miriam that step into some real conflicts and be really and challenge some things. So I had to also make her do that, which is hard for me because I'm Midwestern. And so, you know, that's hard.
I love this idea of it simmering.
I
hadn't really thought of this until just now, but she is speeding along into this choice, you know, is she going to make choices like her mother and, you know, fulfill her parent and her community's vision of who she is as a person, or is she going to make other choices? And it's a simmering is so interesting because she's just plunging head first into it and doesn't see it coming.
Absolutely.
The little warnings throughout, I just keep thinking in our conversation, one of the times she witnesses an act of violence from her father and her dad says, I would never hurt you. And she clocks that. And she recognizes, like, one, is that true? And two, like, what does that mean? That simmering, I'm getting that now. It was there throughout the book in those really small ways too.
I think I tried to really let her, like, she wants to believe her dad. She sees this awful thing. She still wants to believe him.
Of course.
And it's like, is any of this even true? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, her further evolution, you know, when she realizes that she has a gift and, you know, and at first she is tentative and then her confidence grows and she realizes, you know, God is speaking to and working through her and the empowerment that comes from that is just so, it was just one of the things that I loved about her, having one of those moments where I don't know where my question is in this, but just that for me, it became, I don't know, almost the central thing to the book. Like it's
just her, her relationship with God is a part of all of this. And as she's gaining this power, she's still questioning this higher being because of what her father is capable of doing.
Right.
And could you actually talk about that a little bit, how the evolution of that?
Yeah. This would have been a really easy book to write about. You know, I think the expected narrative of this book is, you know, a 15-year-old girl loses her faith after seeing this whole thing. But I think that just as she grapples with her dad and who her dad has become, she's also grappling with her faith. And those trajectories aren't always the same. So she has to separate out what her dad is doing and then she's in some ways trying to figure out her own relationship with God and what that is and what that means.
Right, exactly.
And all of that has to be separated out from this, what her father's taught her and what her father's doing. And so she then has to kind of come to terms on her own with what's actually happening. What's my dad done? What's he capable of? And then what does this mean for my relationship with God? And for, early parts in the book, it is where she's doubting her dad and doubting God at the same time. But then there are parts where she's still struggling with her dad, but feeling more connected with her faith. And so there are these places where I tried to help Miriam make a distinction, because for Joanne, and that's one of the things that Miriam struggles with, is for Joanne, Samuel and God feel like the same. She kind of leaves her family and she goes to Samuel, and then she accepts, you know, she gets baptized and she becomes kind of a follower. And then for Miriam, she does not see them as the same thing, but she's also really, she's angry. Like, why is God letting this happen? Like, why are these things happening in my family because of my dad? And then how is my dad then, when she learns about her gift, how has my dad then been lying to me about this thing that I've thought I am not supposed to have and be and do? And so much of that for her traces her faith and her family, but it's not always linear. And, you know, she gets to a place where she's really ambivalent and angry and distant from her father. And then that is a place where it'd be simple to say, okay, yep, she's done with God too. And she's not.
I love that it would be, you know, quote unquote, easy to say, she doubted God, she lost her faith, she walks away from it.
Yeah.
It's so much, I think, more interesting for her to grapple with, I am a person of faith, and this is not okay.
Because, the idea of like her staying in this family and in this church that's raised her, it's easy to walk away from that. Like, everyone would understand her walking away from that. Like, oh my gosh, get out of here, girl. You're not safe here.
Right, exactly.
And she really has to think about what that means for her. And no one can give her that answer. No one can give her that answer. So that's really challenging for her.
Okay, we have got to talk about the ending.
Yes.
I was at the last like page and a half, so I could see like that there was only half a page left. Yeah. And I was like, what the heck? Like, it's about to be over. So I had to like cover my hand with the other half so I didn't accidentally read the end.
And
I read the end, and literally my jaw was on the ground for like 40 minutes. I texted Jill and I was like, have you read the ending? This is wild.
So I have to tell you real quick.
Yeah.
So I started reading the beginning in the print copy of the book, and then in the and the second half of the book I did on audio because it got into be swim season. On my phone and in my car, it tells you how many minutes are left. And it got down to where it's like 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And I'm like, there cannot be 4 minutes left. Exactly.
They're wrong.
I'm just like, what is going to happen?
I was in such shock. And so I guess spoiler alert, it's like, I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of an open, it is open-ended.
Yeah, it's an open-ended ending.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It's the open-ended ending to end all open-ended endings. And yes. I would imagine, well, I'm curious about people's response to it. I want to hear what you think. I loved it. I think endings are like so difficult. This is one of my favorite endings I've read this year. And I want to know like, just all about it. How did you have to stop yourself from doing more, or did you have to force yourself to do less?
No, the ending was the hardest part of this book for me to write. And I wrote 15 to 20 different endings, and I was just like, oh, how is this thing? Like, I don't know. And I literally for a while was like, I don't know. I'm just going to leave it here. I do not know how this thing is going to end. What have I done? I have this plane in the air and I got to land it and I don't know how, so we're just going to keep these people in the air. And then one of my professors, Margot Livesey, said to me, when the ending is right, you'll feel it. And I was like, what does that mean? I don't know what that is.
Talk about leaving things open-ended.
Yeah, thank exactly. you. Yeah.
And I was reading a bunch of things, and I was reading endings of books I like, and I reread Go Tell on the Mountain. And I was just like, okay, what ending is right for this book? And I literally was like, I don't know. So when that happens for me, with a book, the best thing for me to do is to go back and write by hand. I wrote a fair amount of this book by hand. And I can access my ideas in an easier way when I do that. And so I put the computer down. I was like, I don't have a book if I don't have an end to this thing. And so then I was going to work. I live in Oakland. I work in San Francisco, and I was on BART, and I was like, and I said, wait. And so I sat there and I'm scribbling this ending down. I'm scribbling what this kind of spin out, right? Which is this just Chekhovian spin out, which is all these imaginations and these possibilities of what can happen based on what we have and what we know. I knew I wanted the journey to come in reverse at the end. And then this idea of kind of Miriam spinning out ideas for herself. And then I was like, it was one of those moments of, oh my gosh. And after putting it away and deciding that maybe the book will never end, I then wrote this ending. Pretty much once I wrote this ending, after literally writing so many more that people are like, nope, that's not it. Nope, that's wrong. Nope, it's right. You know, I was like, oh, I don't know. This one, I finished it and I put the period exactly where it is right now. I never went beyond that. And I kind of had a moment of, there it is. And I felt it. And I said, oh my gosh. And so, and after so many tries, that was it. And I never was tempted to say the next thing or to give one. My best friend says, we needed one more word. Like, she's just so mad at me about it. And I think that because the book asks you what you believe and asks you what you think, and leaves lots of things open-ended. Does Samuel ever really heal? Can Miriam heal? Is this all even real? I can't then give you an ending that tells you what she does, right? I can't give you an ending that then closes a door when the rest of the book is spent kind of opening them and letting you decide what you think. And so I wrote this ending and I was like, oh my God, it's going to be bad. And so I sent it in to my agent. I was like, oh, please. Like, you know, I was like, she's going to hate it. And she's like, oh my God, the ending's perfect. And then so fingers crossed with that. And then with my editor, I was like, she's going to make me change this ending. And then she's like, no, the ending's perfect. And so I was like, okay, great. So we're good. So but Margot Olivia was right. I absolutely, like, I almost kind of, I had chills when I finished it.
Right.
And I like clutched my journal to my chest and threw it in my bag and got off the subway and kind of was like, there it is. I'm done. And I was done. But people response, you ask me about responses, there is no middle ground. You either love this ending or you hate it and hate me. And so those two things are, I've heard both of them. So I'm so glad, Michael, that you're on Team Love It, because there are plenty of people who are like, how could you do that? Like, this has to be, you know, and I was like, I get it. So yeah.
I think fiction has sort of made us expect like a certain type of closure, and not all stories are going to do that because it won't serve the story. And I think that, to your point, like, there's so much more of Miriam's life left beyond the last page, that if there was some sort of like perfect bow tied ending, I don't know. I think it would have felt a little contrived, and I just like that I don't know. I love that I don't know, because then these conversations happen.
But no 15-year-old knows where they're really going in life.
Right.
I love that aspect of it.
Yeah. They need to give some parameters so they can give you like a grade. And so it was always like, must be 20 pages long. And I was like, I wanted to do right. So I tended to try and do that. And then I wrote this one story that was like truly like 5 pages long. And I was like, I'm going to get an F on this, but I feel like it's done. Like, And so I emailed my professor and I was like, hey, Chris. Oh, Chris. Shout out to Chris. Hi, Chris. I know like part of the requirement is it's 20 pages, but I just wrote a story and it feels pretty finished. Like, and I'll add more if I really need to. And he was like, if your story has found its end, don't do more to it. And I was like, wow, that's a really good professor. Like, you know what I mean? So I love that advice you were given. Like, it happened for you.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And I doubted it. I said, oh, that's not a thing. This ending. And I was like, I literally was going to chuck my computer. And then it's like, oh, nope, there it is. And I found it.
I love it.
This may seem like a bit of a 180, but I'm just kind of mm-hmm. thinking back about all the different advice and input that you've gotten through this process. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned in the introduction that you were a Rona Jaffe fellow. And I was reading a little bit about their support for emerging women writers, and I found mm-hmm. it so interesting. I'm just wondering if you can share a little bit about your experience there.
Well, so I ended up when I was a Rona Jaffe fellow when I was at Iowa for my first year. And so it was, you know, Iowa is fortunately fully funded. And so I got to spend my first year not teaching, but writing entirely. And so I never kind of went to any of the, they have a ton of programming, but I got to receive that fellowship while I was working on the book at Iowa. And so it allowed me to work on the book without teaching a comp class or creative writing class for my first year, and just actually kind of steep myself in craft and in reading and writing and learning about fiction and kind of having no distractions for that first year, which was so, so, so helpful.
Yeah, I was just really struck. I am so passionate about supporting the work of women and you know, lesser heard voices in that aspect of the workshop. Just really, I don't know. I thought it was so interesting.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful to that foundation for the ability to do what I could do with this book during my first year at Iowa.
We're probably going to wrap up here in a second, but I am just curious, like, what are you working on right now?
So right now, I'm working on this book, and I will say this with the caveat that it may all change tomorrow.
Absolutely.
But it is right now about this kind of charismatic guru, he's kind of a cult leader. They created an intentional community, and it's told from the perspective of three of his wives. And
you have got to write this now.
So it's about kind of them watching his monstrosity and some of their the ways that they are a little bit responsible for some of it, and how they are with him and why they stay and if they leave. So it's tentatively called Kept, and I'm writing from three perspective of three women who are married to him. So yeah, that's what I'm working on right now. I don't know where it's going, and I'm still working my way through it, but
of course, no pressure, but you gotta do it.
That's no pressure, but you must write this book.
We are so thankful and lucky that you were able to join us today, Monica. We want to let our listeners know the book we've been talking about today is Revival Season. We are incredibly grateful to Simon & Schuster, who made it possible for it to be our book club pick. There will be tons of discussion questions on a blog that Michael is writing on our website, bookitpod.com. And of course, we want to hear what you're thinking about our book club pick. So definitely come over to Instagram. Michael's so great about making interesting questions for us to talk about. If you would like to buy a copy of Monica's book, you can do that at our bookshop link, which is bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod. There you go.
We're a team.
I need an assist everywhere I go. Thanks so much for joining us today, Monica.
Thank you so much, Monica.
Thank you for having me. This was really, really wonderful. I appreciate it.
Tsunami has rolled in.
Yeah, and there's nothing we can do about it. Listener, if you hear, we're going to try and talk around it as much as we can, but there is a storm happening.
It's literally raining sideways.
Yeah.
It's wild. And my favorite is that it was coming down in sheets and there was active thunder. And I got a text message that we're not going to call off scouts.
Of course not.
And for another 45 minutes because
let's just see what the rain has to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not going to be like all swampy and flooded and like mud everywhere.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or dangerous.
Monica West.
What a delight.
I loved talking to her.
Me too. And she did that thing where, you know, when you are reading something, it's so, this is what I love about what we do and book clubs in general, is that when you're reading, it's a very personal experience. Mm-hmm. And like you're having your own feelings and opinions, when you go and talk to someone else about it, they maybe had a completely different experience reading it. Go and talk to the author about it.
Yeah.
And her experience writing it is different than my experience reading it, of course.
Uh-huh.
But hers was so special and unique. And
yeah.
Something that I love that she talked about was how, these are her words, subtlety isn't her thing naturally.
Yeah.
And so she had to do a lot of cutting and reworking and rewriting. That I really, really value that as a piece of advice, because it's so easy to look at a finished book, mm-hmm. whether or not you liked it, and be like, how did they do this?
Yeah.
Writing a book must be so easy. And it's like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
They have to do a lot of intentional cutting, and she shared with us a lot of that.
I continue to be surprised. You and I do some good prep work before yeah. we interview somebody, and we usually have some thoughts and questions sketched out so that we can kind of drive the conversation where it's going. But you never know what the other person's going to say. And while a lot of our questions kind of revolve around the same themes,
yeah.
the interviews are different every single time.
Every time.
Were you surprised? Was there anything that just like blew you away? You were surprised?
I was surprised to hear that Miriam started at 13.
Yes.
And not 15.
Yeah.
I was surprised about truly something we talked about with her that you've listened to already, listener, is that we asked her, like, did any other characters have the possibility of like taking over the book?
Yeah.
In the same way that Robert Jones Jr. said. And she said yes. And yeah. she would write like 80 pages in another person's perspective.
I loved that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Especially because then it's like what she said, like it didn't end up in the book, but it informed what is in the book.
I'm dying to read the 80 yes. pages.
I hope we convinced her.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that also was big for me. And this, it had not occurred to me before we talked to Robert about a character taking over a book in a way you're not intending, or it's not their story. And I just feel like that like needs to be a question.
It's my favorite question
in our toolbox now. Like that was,
yeah,
I was blown away by that.
And it also is revealing because it's like, I have my feelings about who that might be, but the author has a different relationship with the characters that they built.
Yeah.
And so I like hearing from Monica who really stuck with her and who she was really interested in that could have been their narrative instead.
Yeah.
And going back to Miriam being 13, what I liked about that was that she said like nothing really had to change about it. The only thing that changed was that she suddenly became the oldest sibling.
Mm-hmm.
And that still like read very true to me because of her situation. A lot of the times Caleb, her middle brother, read like the oldest sibling.
Yeah.
Which complicates a relationship. I think that there are a certain level of expectations based off of when you were born.
Yeah.
And that I think making her older but keeping the narrative basically the same,
yeah,
helped confuse that in the best way.
Absolutely. It was one of those things where she said, I didn't have to change everything. And in my head I was thinking, and yet it changed everything.
Yes.
I also really liked that she said the first thing she saw was this old minivan full of people.
Yes.
And she wasn't sure who they were or where they were going.
Right. Wow.
That was fascinating to me.
In and of itself, kind of a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Something else I really admired too was just, she seemed really, from my perspective, open and vulnerable about her process.
Yeah.
And I think it's really easy to, I get kind of frustrated as someone who wants to be a writer when other writers give advice, which is write every day. You got to make it a commitment, like write every day. And it's like, cool. You have a life that has been set up to allow you to do that.
Yeah.
Because you are a writer. You are a successful writer. Starting out, you don't get the opportunity necessarily. Like we have jobs and families, and it's just a lot harder to do that when you're trying for the first time.
Yeah.
And so I loved that Monica, within that same realm, offered us, yes, I had to cut a lot. Yes, this part of writing is very hard for me. I had no idea how to end this book. She said she had like 40, I'm speaking hyperbolically, but a lot of endings that she had written before she got to this ending.
I loved that she was so open and honest about not knowing how to end this book, especially given how much we loved the ending.
Specifically loved the ending.
But it was so, I just felt like it was amazing to share that.
Yes.
And, you know, again, like I, every time we talk to an author and you hear more and more about their process and everybody's approaching it a little differently.
Absolutely.
But we have been really lucky in that everyone's been really transparent about, I don't, you know, sit down every day and clickety-clack rainbow and sunshine.
Right. And it just came to me and now I'm published. Because yes. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
Well, and she said, what, 7 years, I think it was writing
seven
this?
Or eight or nine. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I meant to mention that and that, yeah. Like, she's in good company because I think both of our other book club picks so far, it took them both. Well, what was Robert Jones Jr.? 13?
I think he said 13 years. And if I'm remembering correctly,
Nancy Johnson was first term Obama.
Obama, yes. Because you and I were like, how did you get this headspace? And she was like,
because I was already there.
I was there.
Yeah. We were like, cool. Thank you for coming to book it. Yeah, I do need to remember that. And I just feel really lucky to be on this side of it because I think Jessica Strasser said this too. It's such a fluke to be a writer. Like,
yeah.
And for it to like work out that. From our perspective, just to be on this side of it and listening to authors tell me about how they wrote this book that I deeply enjoyed, it's just been a treat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, Monica West.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have not yet picked up your copy, our book club pick and the author we talked to was Revival Season by Monica West. It is available in our bookshop, which I can never remember the link to, but Michael does.
Head to our bookshop. It's bookshop.org/shop/bookapod. And we say this all the time, and I just think it's important to remind you that Bookshop is amazing. It is the Amazon of indie bookstores. So yeah. Every time you purchase through Bookshop, financially, they're able to help independent bookstores across the country.
And no one involved is going to Mars.
And no one involved that we know of is going to Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Side note. Yeah.
We also want to thank Simon & Schuster Publishing and Monica West for their help in making our selection of Revival Season work. They were both super generous.
Yeah. And if you are late to the game, if you're not quite finished, head to our website and our Instagram. There are conversation topics ready for you about this book and also the other books that we've read in book club. Join us whenever it's convenient for you. Read at your own speed.
I agree.
Jill?
It's been great.
Talk to you later.
See ya. Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
Book It is available across podcast platforms.
Subscribe to never miss an episode, and don't forget to leave a review before you go.
We'd love to stay in touch. You can find us online at bookitpod.com or on Instagram and Twitter at bookitpod.
Want to read something you heard on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod.
Book It was created by hosts Jill Burkett-Ragacy and Michael Woodson, with sound design and production by Madeline Call at Honeysuckler.